I'm going to introduce you in English, Thomas, since the talk is going to be in English. Mais bienvenue au Collège de France à nouveau. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Thomas Schaeffer to give this seminar. Thomas has been in our group at Collège de France and École Polytechnique for 3 years, and he has now moved to new adventures by being awarded a very nice position at Max Planck Institute Stuttgart, where he leads a research group on strongly correlated electron physics. Prior to all this, Thomas did his PhD at the University of Vienna, where he studied with Alessandro Toschi and Carsten Held. And during his PhD, he's done a really large number of things. In particular, he pioneered the topic that he's going to talk about to us about today, which is how to diagnose the origin of fluctuations in strongly correlated electron systems. And I mentioned in my lecture, and that will be the topic of the next lecture, that in two dimensions, the physics is really entirely dominated by strong fluctuations. So this is a very important tool to diagnose the physical origin and consequences of these fluctuations. Thomas is a Francophone and especially a Francophile. Besides being a wonderful physicist, we have great memories of his stay at the Collège de France, which was in particular the occasion of completing a rather amazing paper, which besides clarifying the physics of the pseudogap in the weak coupling regime in connection with spin fluctuation theory, also provide an extensive comparison of basically all available computational methods available to treat this problem. And I will talk about this paper quite a bit during my next lecture on June 1st. So Thomas, the floor is yours. We would have preferred to have you in person here, but that will be for the next available occasion. And we are looking forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Anton, for this very kind introduction. And thank you for this invitation. It's a big honor and pleasure to give this talk, not in place, but at least virtually, at the place where I've spent nearly 3 years and was a second home to me at Collège de France. So today, what I want to talk about is how can we enable ourselves to read between the lines of electronic spectra, and this is what comes under the name of the diagnostics of fluctuations in strongly correlated systems. But before I start, let me thank the group of collaborators which really pioneered these methods. So first of all, there is Ole Gunnarsson at the Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart, Alessandro Toschi, my PhD supervisor at the TU Vienna, then Georg Rohringer, who is now at the University of Hamburg, Emmanuel Gull, University of Michigan, James LeBlanc, University of Newfoundland, Giorgio San Giovanni in Würzburg, and Jaime Merino in Madrid.
I just also want to mention that also to the audience that we can take brief questions during the talk. I will try to monitor the hands in the Zoom. And at the end of the talk, we can have a more extensive discussion session. Go ahead.
Yes, it's my pleasure. So most of the material which is covered in my talk today, you will find at a recently written review, which I've written together with Alessandro and appeared in Journal of Physics Condensed Matter this year, and also in the seminal papers about the fluctuation diagnostics and the parquet decomposition, which you can see here. So let me start off by doing a Gedanken experiment. And I want you to imagine that you're an experimental physicist and you get a sample, which you know that it's strongly correlated, but you want to get out as many properties as you want. So the first approach of doing this is quite martialic, namely that you simply shoot particles onto your sample, let them propagate through the sample and take them out again. And then you measure the overlap between the final state and the initial state. And this is done in, of course, more complicated experiments like angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy, inverse photoemission spectroscopy, and STM measurements. And I've brought you one a really beautiful example of Anna Tamai and in the lab of Felix Baumberger, who measured this beautiful Fermi surface of strontium ruthenate. And you see, although you can really now distinguish these different sheets on the Fermi surface, alpha, beta, gamma, you can also, so to say, infer these properties, for example, from a DMFT calculation, which was also done in this paper. However, there are some occasions where you get, so to say, a Fermi surface out of your experiment or something else on the one particle level, like this hourglass shape, which are aesthetically pleasing, these Fermi arcs or arches, for example, in the cuprates, or these waterfall features. And in some of those occasions, you cannot immediately infer why these experiments go in such a way they go. So for example, why do I get these arches or arcs in my Fermi surface experiments? Let's stay a moment at this particular example. And let's rephrase the question. So how does the system become excited? And if you would ask me personally the question, how I become excited, the answer would be quite clear cut, namely by a good bottle of wine. However, the answer is not so clear cut in these systems. So for example, in the cuprates, this so-called pseudogap feature has been attributed to spin density wave fluctuations, to phase fluctuations, so pairing fluctuations, and even to charge fluctuations. So it is a bit ambiguous, and the question is, how can we now support this one particle description by additional, in this case, experiments to identify the underlying physics of why we get the spectra in our experiments? Well, one could think of not only shooting one particle onto the system, but actually two, and let them propagate through the system. This can be one way or the other, but you can also think of this as, so to say, exciting the system in a bosonic way, in a certain sense, as can be done, for example, in infrared spectroscopy, inelastic neutron scattering, or nuclear magnetic resonance experiments. And one example is this inelastic neutron scattering experiment on the cuprates, where they measured the spin susceptibility. And you see, you get a quite intense peak here in this excitation spectrum. So you can support, so to say, your one particle level experiment with this two particle level experiment and infer why the one particle spectrum is appearing. So the rest of my talk will actually contain the answer to the question, what are possible strategies for such a fluctuation diagnostics, but on the theories side. So I have brought you here the overview of my talk. I did this introduction. I will very briefly talk about the Hubbard model, because you already heard a lot about this and will hear a lot about this in the lecture by Antoine. Then, as I suppose that you're not familiar with two particle level quantities, I will make a quick tour on those and connect them to linear response theory. I will briefly talk about the so-called vertex, and then the central part will be the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion. And then I will present to you two general approaches to tackle complex problems, which will then consist in the so-called Parquet decomposition of the self-energy. There I will present the Parquet equations and description of the method. I will bring some examples. And at the end, I will also talk about the breakdown of this Parquet decomposition. Then I want to present to you a different approach, namely the so-called fluctuation diagnostics in a narrow sense. So we call this particular method fluctuation diagnostics, which consists of doing partial sums of the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion. I will present some examples also there. And then I will give conclusions, an outlook, and a general perspective on the problem. So let's start off with the Hubbard model, where you heard already a lot about this in the lecture by Antoine. So let me just briefly mention that in this talk, I will consider the simplest modelization of this Hubbard model, namely that we have only two terms in our Hamiltonian, an electronic hopping term, which enables the electrons to hop from one lattice site to another, and a local Coulomb interaction, which has to be paid whenever there's a double occupied site. So two electrons sitting on the same lattice sites with one spin up and one spin down electron. So in this talk, I will only talk about the one band Hubbard model. Mostly, I will present results in two dimensions, and I will not talk about symmetry broken faces, especially SD2 symmetry broken faces. In this talk, I will present some results from different methods, which I will not have time to go into detail. So I will present results from diagrammatic Monte Carlo, and you've heard already, if you followed the course, a beautiful seminar by Fedor Shimkovits. And I will present results from dynamical mean field theory, so DMFT, which retains all the local correlations in our systems, so the so-called self-energy will be purely local, and extensions, namely cluster extensions, for example, DCA, and diagrammatic extensions of DMFT, for example, the dynamical vertex approximation, the dual Fermion approach, or the triply irreducible local expansion TRILEX. And you can find much of this material and a description of the method either in the seminar by Fedor or in this RMPs, which I've listed to you here. So let's start off at basic definitions, and let's start at the basic definitions at the one particle level and then raise our understanding to the two particle level. So I've shown you this process before in an experimental setting. However, how can we describe this one particle spectroscopy now in a theoretical sense? Well, I can label these entries and exit points of the particle of our system. And what I can define is a so-called one particle Green function, namely the fermionic propagator of the system. And you see here that we get a time, the expectation value of a time ordered product of a creation operator at R1 and tau1 and an annihilation operator at R2 and tau2. I can now Fourier transform this object and include the time and translational invariance of my system, and I get the Green function, a one particle level Green function, which is parameterized by a four vector. So a vector in momentum space, which is, has two or three components, and a so-called Matsubara frequency, a so-called fermionic Matsubara frequency in this case, if I'm referring to fermionic particles in my system. And out of this this object, in the real setting, it's much more complicated because you also have matrix elements which you have to consider. However, in this very simple setup, you can retain your one particle spectrum by analytically continuing this object to the real frequency axis. So you get the so-called retarded Green's function. You take the imaginary part, you have a normalization factor in front of it, and then you get this one particle level spectrum. So how to calculate now the one particle level Green function? Well, I can start with a free propagation of my particle. So it does not interact with the system with momentum K. This is the so-called free Green's function, G0. And the basic building block is the local interaction in our model. So the local Coulomb U. And what I can do is I can calculate the full Green function, so the interacting Green function, by taking the G0 and inserting one by one, so-called self-energy insertions. So the self-energy would be a so-called one-particle irreducible object, so the basic building brick. You can think of it, for example, as a Hartree insertion here. I can do this once, twice, and so on, and I can then resum this series, which is then called the Dyson equation. So if I have the G0 and I have the sigma, so the self-energy of my system, I can calculate the interacting Green function. How is this concept now raised to the two particle level? Well, we now shoot two particles in and take two particles out again. I can now label this ingoing and outgoing channels here, and I get the so-called two particle level Green function. So again, I get a time ordered product in imaginary time in this case, but in this time of four operators. So this means that if I do now this Fourier transform, And I will now use the so-called particle hole convention, which is for the experts, so that I get actually three momentum and three frequencies of this particular object with energy and momentum conservation. The particle hole convention just means that I now have two fermionic frequencies, which now are plugged into this four vectors here, and one bosonic transfer frequency in this other object here. We're almost done with definitions, by the way. I can now split this so-called two-particle level Green function in a so-called connected part and a disconnected part. And the disconnected part only consists of products of single particle Green function. And then I can define my so-called full vertex as the so-called amputated object, namely that I take away from this two-particle level connected part four ingoing one-particle level Green functions. This consists of the so-called full vertex. So what does this now have to do with our experiment before, if I know the full vertex? Well, if I want to calculate the physical susceptibility chi, for example, in the charge channel, in the spin channel, in the parent channel, then I can do so by adding a so-called bubble contribution, so the product of two single particle level Green functions, plus a part which contains the so-called vertex correction. And this is exactly this guy. So this guy is now connected here and summed over this internal frequencies. So if I know the full vertex, basically I know my two particle level excitation spectrum, my scattering amplitudes of my system. How can we now connect this one particle level, which I've shown you before, with, for example, the Green function and the self energy to the two particle level? And lucky us, there is an exact relation between this two particle level and the one particle level, which I will show you now in the formulation for the one band Hubbard model, namely the so-called Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion. And I've written it down to you here. So you see that you can calculate the self energy by adding a trivial part, the so-called Hartree contribution, and this full vertex, which is then connected by three Green functions. So diagrammatically, you have something like this. You have your self energy here, you have your Hartree contribution here, you have your full vertex, and you connect them with the Baer-Coulomb interaction vertex here. So if I give to you, so to say, the F and the G of the system, you can calculate the sigma. And this is an exact relation. The question is now, how does this help us to analyze the one particle level spectrum of our system? So in other words, how can we tackle this really complex problem of analyzing this Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion with the full vertex F? And if you're a researcher which is a bit inclined to a humanistic approach, you will find some answers in Latin mottos. So for example, the motto of the Collège de France, of course, is Docet Omnia, so teach everything, which is a nice motto. And I loved, so to say, this this floor tiling here when every time I arrived at Collège de France. However, it is not very constructive. So teach me everything about the system. Okay, what shall I do now in practical terms? Well, but there are other mottos which are a bit more practical. And the two which I want to discuss today is Divide et Impera and Mutatis Mutandis. So Divide et Impera, translated, means divide and rule, and is a Machiavellian motto in a certain sense, which is also applied very often in politics. But this simply means in our case that if you face many Roman legionaries, it would be a very, very bad idea to attack every one of those legionaries as a whole. A much more clever strategy would be that you divide this cohort of these Roman legionaries in subparts and attack those. And this is the basic principle of the so-called parquet decomposition, which I will introduce in a minute. On the other hand, there is a second motto, mutatis mutandis. And this literally means that you have to change what has to be changed. And this can be basically illustrated by going back to the Copernicanian times. Namely, you take a model of the solar system where you put our planet, the Earth, in the middle of the solar system. This would be a very bad description or a very complicated description of the physics. However, you can transform your problem by putting the sun in the middle of your description, and you get a much more simplified version of the description of the physics. However, and this you have to keep in mind, the physics stays the same. So it's just a different aspect, a different point of view which you take. So let's start off by the first motto, divide et impera. So divide and rule. How can we now divide this complicated object, this full vertex F, so that I get parts which I can deal with more easily? And there is again an exact division, which is the so-called Paquet equations. So what you do is you take your full vertex F and you subdivide it into the following parts, and the subdivision is unique. So the full vertex F, we have seen before, contains all the connected two-particle diagrams and can be viewed as a scattering amplitude. This can be divided in a so-called fully irreducible vertex, and three different classes of vertices in the three different channels: in the particle-particle channel, in the particle-hole channel, and in the particle-hole transverse channel. These vertices, this phi, are reducible in these channels. What does this mean at the two-particle level? Well, I've given you here some examples. So let's take the example of the particle-hole reducible vertex. You have here the channels which are the ingoings, and these channels which are the outgoings. And what you can do now is you can cut two fermionic lines in this diagram. And this will separate you, the two ingoing from the two outgoing lines, so to say. And this is what we called particle hole reducible. You can do this also in the three different combinations. So you have the particle-particle channel and the particle-hole transverse channel. However, you cannot do this in the case of the so-called fully irreducible vertex lambda. So it's a very compact object in the sense. And I've drawn here the order of this diagram in the Hubbard model, which is the next one, except for the bare one. So the bare one would be of first order in the interaction. And already the second contribution will be of fourth order, actually. So how can we now use this Paquet equations? By the way, Paquet equations, the term does not stem from a Mr. Paquet. However, you see that in these equations, you couple different scattering channels, namely particle-particle, particle-hole, particle-hole transverse, via this fully irreducible vertex to get the F. And this reminded the people of the tiling of a beautiful dancing floor, where some of the tilings go into each other, and hence stems the name of Paquet equations. How can we now use this concept for our Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion? Well, we can take now this decomposition, and now I've written you down a physical description in a certain sense, namely the so-called SC2 diagonalized form, where we have now indeed the particle-particle channel, the charge channel, and the spin channel for our system. We can take this decomposition, plug it into the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion, and do these summations in the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion. And in such a way, we get a self-energy divided into those different contributions, namely the one stemming from the fully reducible vertex, the particle-particle channel, the charge channel, and the spin channel. So this was the theoretical part, so to say, for the Paquet decomposition. Let's go into some examples. And I've brought you here an example of a general data point data points for the Hubbard model. The techniques here are DMFT and DCA with eight momentum patches. And you can see here that for the 3D cubic half-filled system at an intermediate temperature and intermediate coupling, we get the following. First of all, it's a DMFT calculation, so we only have a frequency dependence in our self-energy. And what you can see here is, or actually you can't see, the exact self-energy for this parameter sets. Namely, it's hidden under this summed curve. But this is good, because actually, if we sum up all the different components of the self-energy, we should arrive again at the exact self-energy, which is, so to say, not calculated from this vertex sum. So you see here that the exact self-energy is plotted here. What you see here is that the main contribution actually stems from the spin channel, which is plotted here in red. And it has, so to say, in a certain sense, the correct sign, namely a negative sign in this case, because we are plotting the imaginary part of the self-energy. What you also see is that the charge, as well as the particle-particle channel, they seem to screen or to counter this contribution of the spin channel here in this case. We can also do this Pakete composition, not only for purely local self-energies, but also in the case of the DCA, which gives you patches of constant momenta. And this is a slightly different parameter set. So you see here that that's for the 2D square lattice, so for a DCA calculation with doping of the system, quite high temperature and an intermediate coupling. You see that, again, the exact and the summed quantities, they are lying over each other. So that's a good consistency check. The spin channel, however, already shows some more or less divergent behavior, so clearly non-metallic behavior, because you cannot do a Taylor expansion anymore here in a good way for low frequencies. Nevertheless, the particle-particle and the charge channel are screening again this spin contribution, which means that the overall self-energy which you get is actually metallic-like. So let's come to a second example, and you will hear about the content of this work, I guess, in some other lectures by Antoine, namely the 2D Hubbard model at half filling on the simple square lattice for a weak interaction value of U equals twice the hopping. So let me guide you briefly through the phase diagram of this model at these data points. What you see here is that we have at t equals to zero an antiferromagnetically ordered state. So we have an antiferromagnet at t equals to zero. However, at a finer temperature, and you will hear about this in the lecture, the Mermin-Wagner theorem destroys this antiferromagnetic order in two dimensions. However, there are still some influences of this antiferromagnetic ground state, which are visible at finer temperatures. So let's start at high temperatures. Here, I will plot you the self-energy for each of those regimes. Let's start at very high temperature. We have an incoherent soup of not yet formed, actually, quasi-particles. And this is reflected in the self-energy, which is for the antinode and for the node, an atomic-like self-energy. If we now cool down the system, we first get coherent excitations in the nodal direction, which means that the self-energy now, at the nodal direction at least, can be crudely approximated by a Taylor series expansion. If we cool further, this is also true for the antinode, so for both now, the node and the antinode. But if we go to very low temperatures, what you will see is that the antiferromagnetic ground state is now near and the system will feel it. So you get larger and larger spin fluctuations in the systems, which first open the gap at the antinode. So you again get eventually divergent behavior at the antinode of the imaginary part of the self-energy, not at the node. And eventually both will gap out at a very low temperature. How can we connect now this one particle level to the two particle level? And this you will hear also about in the lecture. Well, we could, for example, measure the magnetic correlation length in the system. And this is now a calculation which I will show you in a minute again. What we see is that at very low temperatures, we get an exponential increase of the correlation length. And this can be related to the thermal de Broglie wavelength of our quasi-particles in the system. And if this correlation length gets larger and larger and larger, these quasi-particles will scatter and scatter more with these magnetic excitations. And this will localize the particles eventually. And this is the mechanism for a pseudo-gap at weak coupling, which is the so-called Wilk-Tremblay criterion. So you see that we get footprints of spin fluctuations in actually all observables. I've shown you here two, so the self-energy and the magnetic correlation length. But there is something special with this magnetic correlation length here, namely for actually a quite large range of temperature, you get also exponential increase of this correlation length. But it seems that it's a different slope here than at very low temperatures. So let's see whether we can find out something about this with our paquet decomposition approach. And I will show here results, and this is actually already a result from the dynamical vortex approximation with a ladder buildup in the spin channel. So let's do for these parameter regimes this paquet decomposition. If we do this at very high temperatures, so in the region one, which I've shown you before, you see the following thing. So now you have here again the exact self energy. You have a contribution which I called here the rest. So it's the sum of the fully irreducible contribution and the particle-particle contribution. You have the spin here, and you have the charge. So you see again that actually at very large temperatures in this incoherent regime, this irreducible as well as the spin contribution are making up a good fair share of the exact self energy, and that the charge channel is a bit counteracting again. I have to say that the picture is the very same in the nodal direction, because we are at such high temperature that there is no momentum differentiation in our system. However, this changes if we cool down the system, namely we get different solutions now for the antinode and for the node. So let's stay first at the node. What you see here is that basically the exact self energy gets metallic like, so we can do a Taylor expansion at low frequencies, and a fair share of this self energy is brought by the spin fluctuations here. However, if you take a look at the antinode, the situation is a bit different, namely that the total self energy, so to say, is still metallic like. However, the spin part is now so to say gapping out, so it has the wrong slope at low frequencies. At very low temperature, however, the situation changes again. In such that at both the antinode and the node, we get the non-metallic self-energy at low frequencies. And if you really trace these features of the slope for different temperatures, you will see that exactly where we get this first slope in the magnetic correlation length, in its temperature dependence, we see that the antinode is not yet metallic. It's the other way around. The node is not yet not metallic, so there is still a part of the self energy which shows metallic behavior. However, this changes in the second slope, where we gap out also the nodal direction of the self energy in the spin part, and this gapping out that we have a non-metallic part of the spin self-energy is actually true for each temperature in the node, but not in the antinode, but not at the node. Another example of the paquet composition I want to show here in one dimensions, namely the 1D Hubbard nanoring. So this is now a finite size system with four sites at half filling and U equals to 2. You see here that if you plot the non-interacting dispersion relation for a k-vector which is zero, you are off the Fermi surface, whereas for a k-vector where you are at pi half or 3 pi half, you are at the Fermi surface. So off the Fermi surface, you can do this paquet decomposition of the self-energy. And what you see here is that it's a bit of a mixed soup in a certain sense. So no channel is really dominant. You only get the exact self-energy when you really sum up all the channels. However, this changes if you take a look at the Fermi surface. And at the Fermi surface, you have a clear dominant part, namely, again, the spin part of your self-energy. A very last example of the Paketic composition I want to show here now, namely a Paketic composition which is not done on the level of the self-energy, but on the level of a two-particle response function. In this case, the so-called current-current response function. So you can imagine that if you take the governing equation for calculating response functions, namely the so-called beta-salpeter equations, in there, you have the full vertex F. This I've shown you before with this handwritten bubbles and the vertex corrections. And you could now think also of plugging in this Paketic composition of this full vertex F on this level of the beta-salpeter equation, namely that you get the contributions of these different channels to the response function, in this case, the current-current response function. This was done here in this paper by applying the so-called Paketic gamma A, so the Paketic dynamical vertex approximation. The first row here, you have in the main panels, you have the optical conductivities in the 2D Hubbard model for half filling and U equals to 4T for different temperatures. So I would, for the moment, I would disregard the main panels here. In the insets, what you have is the true current-current response function, namely in light color, the bubble contribution, and in this dark color, the full current-current response function. So you see at very high temperature, there are not many vertex corrections in our system. However, if we cool down the system, the vertex corrections are becoming increasingly important. What can I now learn from a Paketic composition of this quantity? Well, at high temperature, you see again, it's more or less the same situation as I've shown you before. So there is not really a dominant channel for the current-current response. However, if you progressively reduce the temperature, and I go down to very low temperature, you see that there is one dominant, namely, in this case, the particle hole transverse channel. So it's not even the spin channel in this case, but it's a mixture of spin and charge in a certain sense. And this has led the authors to an introduction of a new quasi-particle, which they coined the Python, namely a quasi-particle which has a transfer momentum of pi in this case, and it has a dominant contribution for the particle hole transverse channel, whereas the simple particle hole channel, so to say, is more or less featureless also at pi. So these were some examples of this so-called Paketic composition. Let me come now to a problem of this approach. Namely, the problem occurs when we increase our coupling from weak or intermediate, like in this calculation here, to strong. So what happens now if we increase the U? And you see that this decomposition now, which was formerly quite well behaved, now gets a bit chaotic, namely in the certain sense that, first of all, you have a change of sign, for example, of this contribution at higher frequencies. And you have a quite dominant contribution for the fully irreducible vertex here. So you cannot clearly now assign a physical channel in a certain sense to this decomposition anymore. And the question is, why actually is this decomposition becoming so chaotic at large coupling? And the intrinsic reason for this lies in the following. The full vertex, so F, is always, for each coupling, is well-behaved. Well-behaved in a certain sense that there are no strange features upcoming, except if you go close to a physical phase transition, of course. However, this is not true if you decompose this object in this Paketic composition. Namely, what happens in our phase diagram is that at certain points of certain interactions, parts of this Paketic composition become highly divergent. So, for example, this fully irreducible vertex, where this divergence is actually stemmed from, becomes divergent, but also the charge reducible contribution and the particle-particle reducible contribution. However, the dominant channel in a certain sense, namely the spin, stays well-behaved, and the F stays well-behaved. And actually, this is a common feature, as we found out over the years, of strongly correlated electron systems, that this object, namely this frequency resolved object, become highly divergent in the phase diagram of the model, although that there is no physical phase transition actually present. However, of course, in this decomposition, we have to deal with these divergences, which are now at the core of this chaotic behavior. What can we do now? Well, we could, for example, do summations of different channels. So, for example, of the fully reducible charge and particle-particle. And we see that if we sum up all those channels, this composition stays again well-behaved. So you see that the spin channel again is the correct sign and is the dominant one. However, we cannot find out anymore something about the charge and the particle-particle channel. This is called beta-salpeter decomposition. We could also think of a completely different decomposition, which was pioneered here by Friedrich Green and co-workers, namely that we don't take this two-particle reducibility on the fermionic level, but we could think of reducibility on the bosonic level, for example, in this so-called single boson exchange decomposition, and these objects will stay more well-behaved. However, in this talk, I want to present to you another way out, so to say, and let's go back to our Latin mottos. And let's go to mutatis mutandis. So we have to change what has to be changed, namely to get a simple view on our physical problem. How can we do this now? Well, let's take again as a starting block our Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion. We now can write this Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion where you have the full vertex F here written in up-down, in different representations of the physics. For example, instead of this F up down, I could insert the F in the spin channel. If I would do all the summations, one can show that for SU2 symmetric problems, the F up, so to say, drops out. So I receive the same self-energy as before. However, I use a bit of a different object in the summation process. I can do this also in the charge channel, which is also a linear combination of up and up down. And with a frequency transform, I even can do this in the particle-particle channel, so in the particle-particle representation. And let me stress that all these formulations of the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion in the SU2 symmetric case are completely equivalent. So in a certain sense, I have a different perspective on the same physics, and this will lead to a crucial insight. You can now ask the question, okay, sure, I can write this down, and I will get always the same self-energy, so what is the gain in information? Well, you get the self-energy if you sum over all these indices here in the sum. So the K prime, which is, I remind you of this, a four index, so it's a K prime momentum vector, and a Matsubara frequency, a fermionic one, and I sum as well over this bosonic transfer frequency and momentum. However, crucial insight can actually be gained if you leave out some of the those summations, namely if I do partial summations. So how does this work? Well, I take the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion and I, for example, omit the sum over the transfer momentum Q. What does this mean? Well, I get contributions in a certain channel, so in this case in the spin channel, to my self energy, which is now of course a Q split contribution to the self energy. So if I would sum over all the Qs here again, I would again get the exact self energy. I could omit the sum over the bosonic transfer frequency, and then I get such a decomposition in the frequency part. And in what follows, I will plot this Q-dependent contributions of the self-energy in histograms and the frequency-dependent one in pie charts. So let's see what these partial sums can give us for an insight. And let's try this first in a situation which is where we know what to expect, so to say, namely in the case of the attractive Hubbard model. So in the attractive Hubbard model, you have basically a negative U, which means that the electrons do not repel each other, but they want to stay together. So the physical process which is enhanced are charge density wave orderings, as well as pairing, so to say, of two electrons. I will show now some results from a DCA calculation with 8 momentum patches. So this is so to say, the full self-energy, left at the antinode and right at the node. And this is this histogram plot. So you now have, this is the object where the sum over the bosonic transfer momentum has been omitted. And let's focus first on the antinodal part. And there on the spin representation. So we plug in now the spin full vertex and we omit the sum over Q. What you see here is that for these 8 momentum patches present in the DCA calculation, the contributions from the spin channels are more or less equally democratically distributed among those momenta. So in a certain sense, we do not have a clear-cut fluctuation in the spin representation in our system. However, the situation is quite different in the charge as well as in the particle-particle channel. So if we take a look at the charge channel, we have one very dominant contribution, namely at pi-pi. In the particle-particle channel, we also have a very dominant contribution, namely the Q equals to 0, 0. The same is more or less true for the nodal part. If we now do the other partial sum, namely we leave out the frequency summation instead of the momentum summation, what you see here is the following. I've plotted here only the charge in the particle picture. Namely, if you take the fraction of the contribution from the first 10 or so Matsubara frequencies, you see that the main contribution actually stems from omega equals to 0 contributions to the self-energy, which are the contributions which are long-lived, so to say. So we see that in the charge picture, we have the following. We have a very well-defined bosonic mode at pi-pi, which is long-lived. So charge and particle-particle fluctuations are, so to say, the correct picture to view the physics in a certain sense. So let's come now to a bit more interesting problem, namely the repulsive Hubbard model, and especially the repulsive model in the regime where the dynamical cluster approximation gives a pseudo-gap. And again, the pseudo-gap I define here simply as having a gapped self-energy, so a divergent self-energy at the antinode, and a metallic-like self-energy at the node. So what does now this distribution give for us in this case? Well, it's quite clear-cut. It's even more clear-cut than in the attractive Hubbard model. Namely, what you see is here that if I take the charge and particle-particle representation of our problem, we have a really equally distributed momentum contributions for our self-energy, whereas in the spin picture, the spin clearly wins. So we have a well-defined spin mode, which couples effectively to our self-energy in the system. The same is also true if you take the frequency summation. And what you see here is that for the spin picture on the left hand, you have a clear-cut omega equals to zero contribution in the spin picture, whereas in the particle picture, you see that the contributions are distributed amongst the first 4 or 5 Matsubara frequencies. So whereas this lucky turtle is long-lived in the spin picture, in the particle picture is somehow a pure dayfly. So these pioneering calculations have been then later supported by additional calculations. For example, in this nice work of Dong and Emmanuel Gull, namely that the scanned a large portion of the phase diagram of the Hubbard model in DCA, and they did such an analysis again in the charge and in the spin picture, and the outcome is quite amazing, and the same as we saw before, namely that in the charge picture you get contributions to the self energy from many different Q vectors and many different frequencies, whereas in the spin picture this is quite clear cut, and in this case anti-ferromagnetic contribution and more or less nothing in the other momentum transfers. A very nice work which actually has been performed at my second home as a postdoc by Wei Wu and collaborators, namely at Collège de France, is a calculation in diagrammatic Monte Carlo, in the pseudo gap phase which defined in diagrammatic Monte Carlo. So you have a nodal part here which is metallic, and an antinodal part which is diverging here. The big advantage, of course, of diagrammatic Monte Carlo, except from being exact if the series converges, is that you have a continuous momentum resolution in your system. So this means is that instead of these histogram plots, which I've shown you before, they can really do these color maps here. And you see, however, the same picture as before. So in the particle-particle and in the charge channels for the antinode and node, you only see this Fermi surface connecting vector features, so to say, in this distribution. Whereas in the spin channel at the antinode, you see a clear-cut bosonic contribution at pi-pi. And at the node, you even see an incommensurate wave vector here, which is contributing to the self-energy. So beautiful calculation there. You can ask now the question, okay, I hope you believe me that this calculation is correct, but what about D-wave pairing fluctuations in our system? And what we can do is we could write down the D-wave pairing correlator, namely this pairing correlation function, which consists of a four-particle operator here, the expectation value of it, and a form factor which gives you the D-wave. If I want to have this guy large, namely that the D-wave pairing fluctuations are large, then this correlation function here should be proportional to the form factor in order to give a large contribution, and especially the sign of this large contribution should be equal. However, if you now analyze a bit more the formula for the fluctuation diagnostics, so the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion, you see that if you have the Q equals to zero contribution in the particle-particle channel, the same correlator shows up in the fluctuation diagnostics of the self-energy as for the D-wave pairing correlator. But then, of course, I do not have a form factor here. So this sign will not save me, and the overall contribution to the self-energy is small. So this means also if I have strong pairing correlations in my system, this does not mean that they effectively couple to the self-energy of my system. So one has to be a bit careful for making this statement. As a last application of this fluctuation diagnostics, I want to show you something which is so to say an a posteriori qualification of the so-called Fields parameter in a mixed fermionic bosonic language. What does this mean? So I can build up diagrammatic theories not only in purely fermionic languages but also in a mixed fermionic bosonic language. And one technique which does this is the so-called Trilex approximation. Essentially, this consists in separating or decomposing the Coulomb interaction U in a density-density part and in an interaction of two spins, which gives you a different coupling constant for these two different channels. However, they are related by this relation here. So the thing is, in this theory, you have now the so-called Fields parameter, which I call the alpha, where I can tune now the ratio between the charge and the spin channel. And this ratio between the charge and spin, I call here now X. In this theory, this Fields decomposition is ambiguous. So you can now scan these parameters, and very often a problem arises when you have to fix this parameter to a certain value. How could now this fluctuation diagnostics help us? Well, let's plot this parameter for a moment. So this Fields parameter as a function of this ratio of U spin and U charge. If you go back now to a histogram plot, we could think that a good estimate for example, performing such a Trilex calculation in this parameter regime could actually be gained by comparing the dominant contributions of the spin and in this case of the charge channel. So let's take the dominant contribution of the spin contribution to the self energy divided by the same of the charge, which is of course less. And this would give a ratio for the first Matsubara frequency of about 4. And in our plot here, this 4 would correspond to an alpha, so to a Fields parameter, which is 1/3. And if you go back to this coupling constants here, you see that a parameter of 1/3 actually corresponds to the fact that the charge channel is completely suppressed in our theory. We did this estimate, and we did a calculation for the Hufeld-Hubbard model for the correlation length in the Trilex approximation and compared to diagrammatic Monte Carlo as a benchmark. And what you see here is that if you take a Fields parameter, which is 1/2, you get a quite also qualitative wrong behavior of the correlation length. Whereas if you take this actually crude estimate, because this was not the same parameter regime as the calculation which we've used it for, you get a much better comparison to the benchmark. So this was my last example, and let me conclude now. So what I've shown you in this talk is that there are general strategies for gaining insights of in the spectra of correlated systems via the Dyson-Schwinger equation of motion. The prerequisite for this is that in your technique, although this technique is very versatile, you have to have access to both one and two particle level Green function. And it would be good if both of them are in a certain sense unbiased, although I've shown you some insights which have been gained for biased techniques, where, for example, the spin channel is dominating. And if you have these prerequisites, you can do basically two things. You have this packeted composition. Compared to the fluctuation diagnostics, it's numerically heavier because you have to rely on packet inversions there. And you saw that it's unstable for increasing U. However, it's also generalizable to response functions. The fluctuation diagnostics, on the other hand, is a relatively lightweight post-processing method, which is quite flexible, and it's applicable everywhere because it relies on the full vertex, which does not have these problems of divergences. Let me stress once more that these two basic strategies are very versatile. So you saw now in the talk that many techniques could be applied, for example, diagrammatic Monte Carlo, DCA, and so on. And they have led to many applications, and not all of them I've shown in my talk. So apart from these two seminal papers, there is also a so-called fermionic packetic fluctuation diagnostics. There are insights of the null antinull dichotomy in the Hubbard model at weak coupling from packet dual fermion. There was a fluctuation diagnostics recently done for the nail ordering in DMFT. There was even fluctuation diagnostics done for phononic self energies and fluctuation diagnostics in the dual fermion approach. So it's very versatile and has become increasingly popular these years. So what to expect next? Well, we want to apply, of course, these fluctuation diagnostics to extensions of the Hubbard model, for example, to multi-orbital systems, and we have already something in mind already together with Antoine, to symmetry broken faces, and even to do some real space analysis there, for example, cluster diagnostics or symmetry diagnostics of the self energy. So with that, I want to thank you again for the invitation. I want to thank you for your attention, and I really, really hope that I will be able to visit Collège de France soon, because the times there were pretty amazing for me. Thank you very much.